The Anesthesia Podcast.
Welcome to this month's Anesthesia Journal Podcast. I'm absolutely delighted this morning to be joined by Dr. Nikolai Bangfoss, who's an Associate Editor of Anesthesia. Welcome, Nick. Good morning. It's been a while since I saw you in person, actually. I think it was before COVID, and it was a meeting in London in January 2020, which was now over 4 years ago. Can you believe?
Well, hi, and thank you for having me on. Nice to see you again. As you say, it's been a while since we saw each other. We're just slowly ramping into the conferences again and meeting up instead of online. I have my research career here in Copenhagen has been based on a mentorship I had with Henrik Kielet and working with the fast track surgery and enhanced recovery. Originally, my research was mainly into hip fracture surgery and perioperative care, and that's how I actually got associated with the journal early on through Stuart White. I've been working with the journal since then. My interest has in the later years, since doing more and more research and my professorship, it's been into emergency laparotomy and hemodynamics, all within the concepts of enhanced recovery. And we've been doing large cohorts of emergency laparotomy. So I think UK and Denmark are sort of the epicenters of that research, and which also hip fractures, emergency laparotomy sort of fueled my interest in hemodynamics, which we're doing a lot beside pain research and optimizing recovery. So that's my research background and what I'm doing at the moment.
Yeah, and I think it'd be fair to say that a lot of the work for which you're known is very clinically focused and very important to everyday clinicians that are looking after patients, which kind of fits nicely with the papers that you've chosen from this issue, because they're all very clinically focused papers. We had a couple of months ago papers about burnout and syringes, and then last month we had lots of papers about sustainability, but this month we've got three really core clinical papers to talk through, which are really interesting. So I think you've picked some really good ones here. And as it happens, this first paper might seem to readers that this is about a anesthetic agent, but it's actually there's a message in this paper underneath, which is about hypotension, which is an area of in which you're an expert. It's about a new agent called remimazolam, which is a short-acting benzodiazepine, which lends itself very well to total intravenous anesthesia. I've never seen it in clinical practice before. I know it's used in some parts of the world, and in Europe particularly, it's been used in this trial as a sort of phase three randomized controlled trial. And there has been lots of research and lots of interest in this area, and we get papers submitted to us about remimazolam all the time. But what's really interesting here is I've compared it to propofol in a very sort of non-inferiority design, and I've also looked at hypotension. So have you ever heard much about this agent, Nick? Have you used it? Why did you find this paper in particularly so interesting?
Yeah, I found it was interesting in many ways, because when we look back at the invention of remifentanil, we came into something that was pharmacologically sort of the ideal anesthetic. You can give very high doses and have patients awake and available for recovery in a very short time. So that combined with propofol has been sort of the mainstay of my practice. And now we have something that is challenging propofol, remimazolam, with a similar kinetic. And obviously, it's the ideal situation is to give patients adequate depth of anesthesia and have a very early and sedative-free recovery. So I think there is a potential here. It has just been started marketing out in Europe and in Denmark, where I work. It's been free for sedation, and it's been marketed for that. And we have had it through our department, but it hasn't been available until just recently for general anesthetics and intensive care. And I think it's extremely interesting to see what is the place for this drug, how can we use it. One thing I found interesting is now we have a hypnotic with a reversal agent. But now we have a benzodiazepine we can give potentially extreme depth of anesthesia and of sedation, and we can potentially reverse it. So obviously it's interesting to see how does this work compared to the other drugs we're having at the moment. So I think there's a perspective for research here, and to see what. But as with all new things, the question is not if we should use it, is when and how and for what?
Yes, I mean, it raises all sorts of interesting research questions as well about if we were to introduce a new anesthetic agent into clinical practice, how would we do that? And I guess the non-inferiority design would lend itself quite well to that, although it is a design that has a lot of critics, obviously. And we often hear people will sort of mock that trial design by giving the phrase, which is often given, which is that something is not non-inferior, which is really quite confusing because it's like a double negative. And indeed, that's what the paper found, is that remimazolam was non-inferior to propofol, not non-inferior, if that makes sense. Yeah. Can you just briefly sort of go over that method? Because it's actually quite confusing, and people will often struggle to work out what exactly is trying to be shown and what exactly the paper finds.
Well, it's obvious that you have this drug which you compare to something when with propofol, you can give the depth of anesthesia you want. It's just a matter of dosing, and therefore, obviously, the sign is actually, even if you understand non-inferiority, a bit difficult to grasp, because non-inferiority will show you that you won't have a poor result with this, and that will be okay. Then you can look at side effects, and it's all wound up into the concept of your primary outcome. And non-inferiority want to say, okay, this works as well as the other stuff. Then we can look at all the side effects. How did they go? And it's based around the concept of usually you have one primary outcome, which, by the way, I think this paper digresses a bit upon by having a primary, secondary outcome or so of hypertension. that's a methodological discussion. I think it's a fair concept to say, well, can we give adequate amount of anesthesia with this drug? But looking at it this way, you could also say, looking at the data, did they really give that? Because they had inferior depth of anesthesia with remimazolam in the doses they designed the study to give.
Yeah.
I think the question really is, they monitored a depth of anesthesia with Narcotrent. The question is, could you give deeper anesthesia, or were they inhibited by the pre-described drug doses that were made for the study? I think that's an interesting question, because even if it's not statistically non-inferior, I would say there's a huge difference between achieving the Narcotrent values they set out in 93% of the patients receiving remimazolam, as opposed to 99% of patients receiving propofol. That could say, well, if we were to use this, we wouldn't achieve our intended depth of anesthesia in 6% of the patients. But is that the drug or the doses used? We don't really get those answers from that study.
Yeah, it throws up all sorts of questions, doesn't it, about fundamentally how do we compare two intravenous anesthetic agents? And I guess that's all quite, in 2024, for a lot of us, that's actually quite a new concept to get our heads around, because we don't tend to see a lot of this research much. We tend to see other things such as complications or outcomes, rather than using depth of anesthesia as a sort of primary outcome. They use Narcotrent to measure depth of anesthesia. Is it fair to compare propofol versus a benzodiazepine using that monitoring as a primary outcome?
Well, we don't know. Well, the problem is with the whole concept of depth of anesthesia monitoring. There's been recent large meta-analysis that show they don't impact mortality when you do a depth of anesthesia monitoring. We don't know what the correct depth is, which also ties us together with hypertension, because basically the concept of anesthesia is that we can provide depth of anesthesia so the patient is deeply sedated. Can we wake the patient up? Yes, if we have short-acting drugs. What are the side effects? They list hypertension. Hypertension, is that a direct consequence of the drugs or due to some pathologies due to the depth of anesthesia? Which also brings us back to all the studies on depth of anesthesia monitoring, where we really don't know whether any negative outcome associated with depth of anesthesia is simply due to inadequate handling of the hemodynamic side effects of anesthesia. Sometimes I think we're discussing, should we give hemodynamic support to the patient by not anesthetizing them very deep, or should we just vasoconstrict them? And I think we're sort of not really going into the issue here. We have different concepts with studies into depth of anesthesia monitoring. Others are doing how do we get hypotension? And a lot of anesthetists say, oh, I have hypotension, or I have preload dependency due to sympatholysis. Then I decrease the depth of anesthesia to wake up the patient up slightly so that I don't have this. And we don't really know what the answer is to this, because that gives the patient surgical stress. So I think we are sort of measuring different things against each other, which we don't really know how they interact. And we don't really know what the main issue is.
Yes, yeah, so I guess it's quite difficult then to take this further and to prove that an agent would be, say, superior in certain patients. And one of the ways that that's sort of hinted towards in this paper is about hypotension.
They come out with hypertension. And the thing is, if you look at the narco trends, the group with remimazolam has less anesthetic depth than the propofol group. And therefore, they have a bit less hypotension. But then again, why do you even get hypotension in a group where you have free use of norepinephrine in the study protocol? I could make any anesthetic without hypotension with free use of norepinephrine.
Can I assume then that you don't agree with the conclusion of the paper, which is that this new agent might find a specific role for those with risk factors for hypotension? Is that too simplistic? Do we need to work on this a bit further and maybe more focused studies in this area before we can say those things? Because that's based on secondary outcome data as well, isn't it?
I think the problem is if you don't give the exact same depth of anesthesia, then the group with less anesthetic depth will have a bit less hypotension. And we've had a real problem in interventional studies correlating hypotension to outcome. It's an association, not necessarily a causality. And the chasing of depth of anesthesia by decreasing the depth has also not really been shown to be successful. So I think there are some concepts underlying the paper as this being a reason for using the drug doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. But I think there are situations where you want really long sedation, you want something that can have a reversal of the anesthetic by an antidote, that could be useful. But the concept of very slightly diminished degrees of hypotension by a little less anesthesia, I don't think we can really conclude anything on that.
This paper's got something for everyone, hasn't it? Because you've got the methodological aspects of non-inferiority. You've got to think about this group who are setting out to compare one anesthetic agent with another for TEVA, and then to measure the outcomes of depth of anesthesia and hypotension, and then try and make some clinical sense of all that. I think for any anesthetist out there who's wants to spend half an hour reading this paper and trying to get their head around it, I think that's time well spent, because for all of us, this is really fundamental to the work that we do and to future research studies that we might see. So I think it's really useful paper to use for CPD purposes, and I'd recommend everyone go and read that. Would you agree?
Yeah, exactly. And just a final comment on it, because it is an unblinded study. They use remifentanil. They have the ability within the protocol to give 0.5 remifentanil as an infusion, and they give 0.2 in one and 0.24 in the other group. So depth of anesthesia, is that remimazolam or propofol, or the dose used of remifentanil? There's something there that just, to me, doesn't really add up.
I think we're going to see a letter of correspondence from your group on this, and it'd be really nice to see some of those points put to the authors and to get them to respond. I'm going to move on to the second paper, which is from the PQIP delivery team and their collaborative. And we're seeing quite a lot of papers coming from this group, which is really great. And we're obviously delighted to have this really important work, which a lot of people have spent a great amount of effort generating, and it's really nice to see the paper come through. And it's actually generated quite a lot of interest on social media already. For me, this was a really useful paper as it looks at morbidity, so complications rather than mortality. And we know the limitations of looking at mortality and using that to generate consent discussions with patients and to try and inform our patients. But patients don't tend to come and talk to doctors about mortality associated with surgery, because that's very rare. They get worried about complications and serious complications. So why did you pick this paper, Nick? And why did you find it interesting?
Well, I think, as you said, it's a huge collaborative effort, and that is to be applauded. And it's within the concept of the whole dreaming and optimizing perioperative care. And that's what I've been working with my whole career. We used to call it ERASA fast track, now it's Breaming, but it's sort of the same brew in different ways. And it's all about optimizing the perioperative pathway of the patient. And obviously you have big data on that, and it's a huge project. And then an obvious thing when you sit with all this data is to see, okay, how can we predict poor outcome and how can we predict complications? I think it's a worthy subject with the case mix they have, even though it's, I read up on the case mix of surgical procedures and it's quite specific. As I read it, for example, in orthopedic surgery, it's very specific procedures that they have as opposed to a lot of the procedures that actually make up the majority of the surgical cases that we have in our practice. So I think there's some specific limitations on to where it can be used. And then there's a problem is of how are we going to use this in the clinical practice? Because when you look at the data that comes up, if I were to play the devil's advocate, we'd say if the patient is sicker or older and can't walk as much, the surgery will have a worse outcome. And did we know that already? And how exactly can we use that to sort of navigate in our practice? Because we have this situation before surgery where we can have a communication with the patient and we say, well, you're elderly and a bit sicker, so you'll have a worse outcome, but the AUC is around low 70s, moderate risk. How can we use this to improve outcome of the patients? That's a problem. And I think that's something for the future, because we know that in the majority of issues or cases where we've actually improved outcome, our research have been procedure specific. And we have something with a lot of different procedures, a lot of different perioperative pathways. And how are we going to use this in sort of a broad stroke approach? That is it better than just saying, well, if you don't walk as fast or have cardiac disease or elderly and high ASA score, then you'll probably have a worse outcome. Does it really add on top of that?
So what I liked as well is the fact that this doesn't shy away from that complexity that you describe as well. And I guess a lot of temptations there for scores to try and be as simplistic as possible. But I think what this paper shows really for me is that it's not possible to do that most of the time, when actually some of the factors that go into complications and predicting those complications are actually quite complex.
All my original search was in hip fractures, and I was so frustrated looking at the research in publications in hip fractures. 98% of them is associations with complications and mortality. If you have low hemoglobin, if you don't walk so well, if you come in and whatever. And the problem is that it's like the weather. Everybody's talking about it, but nobody's doing anything about it. And the thing is, we have these patients, and I would love the idea that we have had a pathway where we said, oh, if you score like this, you have this risk, and we do the anesthetic like this, or we put this goal-directed therapy on top, or we do that. But the problem is, at the moment, I'm not talking about the future, it might be different, but at the moment, we don't really have good evidence base that said, if your score is like this, I'll do the anesthetic like this, or I'll do the perioperative care like this. Even if we tried to put high-risk patients in ICU, we didn't really alter outcomes. And that's one of the issues. I'm not saying we shouldn't try to predict risk, but I'm saying, well, the big leap is going from risk to alteration of outcome.
They use a really interesting grading scale here for postoperative complications, which is the Clavien-Dindo postoperative complication grading. And any grade two or more, I think one grade one complications are very minor, probably not all that relevant to patients. But anything over two before hospital discharge was counted as a complication. And I think they then combined all those complications together as a composite outcome. And we've seen quite a few papers recently looking at postoperative complications that are using this grading scale. Is this a sort of an emerging way to grade morbidity in these studies? And would you recommend that for other trialists?
Yeah, I think it definitely has some validity, and it's been used a lot in surgical science. I've been using it in studies for years, specifically in our emergency laparotomy trials. And there's some good and some bad in it. Obviously, the good thing is that the higher scores, Clavien-Dindo 3 and 4, they're very sort of solid in that it's a reoperation or a multi-organ or single-organ failure or ICU admittance. So Clavien-Dindo 3 to 4 or 5, that's death. those are really solid outcome data that are easy to assess. Once you go into two, it's class two, it's more difficult. Pneumonia, it's really hard to classify pneumonia in big studies and get a consistent outcome. And the other things that sort of deviate from the normal patient course, they are harder to qualify. And I'm not quite sure that once you go into class two, whether it's more solid to have length of stay, because usually patients get discharged once they're fit. And if you have a class two, but you're still discharged after 2 or 3 days, was it really relevant? So I think it's both, or I think class three or four is really solid. Class two is difficult. And in our fast track research in Denmark, we have this where you simply if you're in hospital longer than your expected time, that's a negative outcome as well. And perhaps that's more solid than class two. I don't know. Class two is difficult, but I think clavulanidindo is something that is used and will be used. And I think it's something that everybody who does surgical science in some way or reads about it should be familiar with.
Yeah, it's really patient focused, and it was really good to see that. And we've already had models for mortality, we've had models for pain, and now we can also potentially predict complications as well. I know there is some further work that's required before we're probably able to say that 100%. But what else do you think might be important for us to be able to predict and look at in these types of studies in the future?
Well, I think, as I hinted at before, I think sort of narrowing it down, I think we need more granularity. I think we need to say, well, in this patient course, there are some specifics. For example, in this, there is emergency laparotomy, 10% is emergency patients, 90% is elective. And to be honest, I don't think they can be compared. I don't think sort of the models aren't linear in that way. They don't really predict in a similar fashion in such diverse patient courses. So I think in the future, we actually need to be more procedure specific. I think it's, and if you look at the, in the paper, you can see that in the COVID period, where you had a different set of procedures, the model overpredicted complications. So I think there's the case mix has everything to do with how your model performs. So I think the more we could do it specific to how things are done and the procedures that are being done, I think the better we can approach this in a rational way that will affect the way we actually do the anesthetics and the perioperative cases. So I think more granularity is needed. I think the road forward is not these broad approaches. I think we need to be more granular.
The actual paper brings together a model using 11 variables, which are all patient-based risk factors. Some of them are actually modifiable as well, as you've mentioned. But is such a model too complex for use in routine clinical practice? Or is that something that is kind of put to one side now because we're all using EPRs and because actually a lot of the hard work of using such models can be automated in some way?
I would say that the factors that are put into the model, length of surgery, that's obviously procedure specific, but the patient related facts, can you walk? What's your ASA score? Do you have dyspnea? Do you have cardiac failure? Are you anemic? What's your age, smoking history? That's sort of part of any pre-anesthetic history. I don't think the complex, the model by itself sort of have complex things included that anesthetists wouldn't already assess. The question is whether the exact number you get from the model, what decision can it be used for? Yeah. I have a model, I put the data into a model, I get an odds ratio for the patient or a risk, and then I'm going to talk to the patient and say, should you have this surgery?
Yeah,
and
I guess there's got to be a way in which the plan for patients is modified, hasn't there? So there's got to be whether or not they go to a critical care area afterwards, or you use more monitoring, or like you say, whether or not you it really reframes that risk-benefit discussion with patients and you decide to go for a different therapy, for example, a minimally invasive option or actually medical therapy rather than, you know, something that's invasive and surgical.
Exactly. And I think any sort of risk model needs to be associated in research with a clinical decision tree. And you need to see that that model adds quality of patient care to that decision tree for a better outcome.
So I'm going to move on to the final paper, which is a really nice editorial. I'm really glad you picked this, actually, because there's very little in this that I was able to sort of argue against. I think it's essential reading for all anaesthetists. I think I think we're going to look back on this area of practice maybe in 10, 20 years' time and think, well, we actually, there was a really big gap in between our knowledge and how we practice clinical anesthesia in terms of neuromuscular blockade and more specifically reversal of neuromuscular blockade prior to emergence and quantitative neuromuscular blockade monitoring. So there's a paper from Rodney et al. It's not associated with any particular paper. It's a standalone editorial.
First of all, it's for me coming from the anesthetic culture that I've been trained in and practiced in. The main thing is for me, it's sort of a complete no-go to use neuromuscular block without monitoring.
Things are very different here in the UK.
Yeah, and obviously Copenhagen was a focus of a lot of neuromuscular blockade research. But I think there are two issues with neuromuscular blockade. First, if you're going to use it, it has two potential consequences. One is awareness. And the other is potential post-operative residual blockade, which will lead to respiratory complications. And if you're going to use a neuromuscular block, then you need to be prudent in the way you're going about monitoring the patient. I would say, first of all, you need to be prudent in the way you're monitoring depth of anesthesia and make sure that the patient actually don't have awareness. That is the highest risk factor for awareness, that's neuromuscular block. Second to that, you have the residual block, which I think it's irresponsible not to monitor that in a quantitative way. And specifically, as they point out eloquently in the paper, that even if we have sort of the magic drug Sugammadex, and we still will have potential residual block. It's not a cure-all for that condition. And I think sort of the practice of anesthesia has been lulled into complacency as regards neuromuscular block by the emergence of Sugammadex. And I think this editorial points that out very well. And I think that that the monitoring is essential. For me, it's incomprehensible why it's not mandatory. And then there's also the other issue of how much neuromuscular block should we use, when, and why? Because in my practice, it's declining immensely.
There's a sentence that stands out for me in this editorial, which is quite clear and quite cutting, actually, and it suggests that anaesthetists are perhaps sometimes overconfident in their knowledge of basic concepts surrounding neuromuscular blockade use, quantitative monitoring, and reversal of neuromuscular block with even the neostigmine or Sugammadex. Do you think this overconfidence, which it's very, very hard to argue against that because the way we practice in this area, and this is actually very, when you do look into the way in which we're supposed to monitor neuromuscular block and we're supposed to choose the dose of antagonist and timing around that, etc., it's actually quite a lot of nuance to that, and it's not as straightforward as some people probably think. Do you think that's to blame for this sort of widespread failure to monitor neuromuscular function quantitatively in a lot of areas?
But I think as with the majority of things we do, it's culture. It's culture.
Yeah.
Brought up in a culture where it's accepted, I think it's acceptable. And the problem is the complications that are secondary to this is not something that's in your face. It's not a I can't intubate situation you get into. It's perhaps, oh, this very sick patient, oh, they had pneumonia postoperatively. It's not really on your shift, in quotation marks. And I think that's that gives complacency, and I think culture and leadership in departments has everything to do with this.
And of course, there is Sugammadex, and that does change things, but it doesn't solve all the problems, does it?
Oh, exactly, and it's also associated with potential complications. And I think that it brings me back to the issue of how and why are we using neuromuscular blockade? Because we know now that we can easily intubate without neuromuscular blockade by using remifentanil. I use it exclusively in my practice. I've been doing a bariatric surgery for years, 10 years, and hardly ever use neuromuscular blockade in that practice. We do all the intubations on remifentanil. And it's becoming becoming more and more widespread in Europe to use remifentanil. There's been recent papers on non-inferiority with even in emergency abdominal cases. So I think we can safely intubate without neuromuscular blockade. Then we need to assess how and how much should we use it intraoperatively, because it doesn't add to the recovery of the patient. Patients don't get less complications or leave hospital earlier because of neuromuscular blockade. So I think we need to take a hard look at our practice and say, how are we using it and when are we using it and why? And it's really dodgy, the evidence on a deep neuromuscular blockade for laparoscopy. It's basically about the depth of anesthesia you provide. If you don't anesthetize the patient very deeply, then you use a lot of neuromuscular blockade. If you do a deeper anesthesia, you don't need it.
And I guess the issue around cost is really interesting as well. We've already had that debated in the journal before. It's not just as simple as, you know, Sigamidex is really expensive and we shouldn't be using it, because if we're actually selecting the appropriate neuromuscular blockade agent, the appropriate antagonist, and choosing the right dose and the timing, along with quantitative assessment and education of anaesthetists in how to do that properly, then that mitigates against the potential associated costs of extra monitoring and then using Sigamidex if we're going to use that instead of neostigmine, because we're going to reduce complications and the costs associated with one patient having an unnecessary pneumonia because they've not been reversed properly will probably more than account for a lot of those associated costs. So it's actually quite difficult and not as straightforward as the arguments that extra monitoring and expensive drugs don't.
Yeah, I think there's a really good case financially also in preventing. You don't need to prevent a lot of complications to finance whatever you're doing in monitoring wise, and that we can see that consistently with the majority of enhanced monitoring systems, that in the reduction of complications usually offset any cost. And I think it's even if it costs something, how can you argue that a patient should accept residual blockade with a potential complication because of something that's not that expensive?
That's a striking argument to finish on, I think. And also what I found interesting from the there's a really good infographic in the paper as well, which I'd encourage everyone to have a look at, was the fact that the monitoring should be applied at the start of surgery and used throughout as well, which I don't think is something that's done commonly in the UK. Is that something you do?
Well, we monitor until antagonism, and it's obligatory to put on a monitor if you're using neuromuscular blockade. But that being said, I would also like to say that I think the Sigamidex have introduced a sort of complacency, and the whole concept of deep neuromuscular blockade was hugely advanced, I think, to some degree, to sell the drug. And I think there's a really poor evidence for the deep neuromuscular blocks that have been given to some kind of surgery. So I think use as little neuromuscular block as you can, and if you do, monitor it.
Thank you very much, Nick. I really enjoyed that discussion with you about those papers. And I think that really goes to show that there are so many different ways in which you can approach the reading of a paper. You can look at the methods, you can look at the clinical implications, but there's lots of topics that feed in often to a lot of these clinically orientated papers that we absolutely love here at Anaesthesia. And we really enjoy talking about our papers. And hopefully listeners will appreciate the fact that this format in a podcast, it makes a lot of these concepts really accessible to everyone and can be used for CPD as well. So I hope you enjoyed that as well, Nick. I really look forward to seeing you in person again at some point, which I'm sure we'll all do.
Oh, I love that. I'm always very happy to come to the UK. I think we have a lot of things that we share in our practice of anesthesia and research, and it's always great to come over and meet colleagues. And it's been enjoyable being on the podcast, as you say. I think it's a really good format to expand and discuss from different angles the clinical papers, because there's so much assumed in the reading that somebody else who have a different clinical context might rethink completely different.
Absolutely, completely agree. So thanks very much, Nick, and we'll see you hopefully very soon.
Thanks, bye.
The Anaesthesia Podcast.